He tried taking water from toilets, but it's Secretary Not Sure who finds himself in the toilet now. And as history pulls down its pants and prepares to lower its on Not Sure's head, it will be Daddy Justice who will be creeping on him this time.
Welcome to another episode of Reverse Deception Radio. Today in studio, we have a very special guest. His name is Steve Bongart, and I'm going to give you a little background on him first, and then we're going to get into some really fun discussions. Steve grew up in Bel Air, Maryland. After graduating from the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, he went on to Pensacola, Florida, where he became a naval aviator. He flew F-14 Tomcats off the USS Enterprise, which I slept on one day when I was out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and the USS Lincoln. He flew F-5E Tigers, which probably only a few of you actually out there really realize what that is, as an adversary, aggressor pilot, where he attended the Naval Fighter Weapons School, the Top Gun School. He left the Navy and went on to work on Wall Street, where he focused on corporate bond and stock option sales to institutional clients. And in 1995, Steve became an FBI special agent after surviving Quantico, or the boys' school. He went back to New York City, and he started working there for the Bureau. During his career, he served as an FBI profiler at the BAU, not the BAU that you see on TV. This is a different one. And later as an instructor at the BSU, specializing in cyber-related offenders, remote personality assessment, and language analysis. Additionally, he was a SWAT operator, sniper, and a computer forensics examiner. As a field case agent in New York, he worked on all major Al-Qaeda terrorism investigations, including 9/11. Finished his career in Washington, D.C., he worked extremely sensitive national security investigations dealing with counterterrorism and espionage matters. Highlights of his career include being the first hand-picked team of FBI agents that went into Afghanistan in December 2001 after 9/11, and starting the Cyber Behavior Analysis Program at the BAU. His efforts to fight the FBI and CIA bureaucracy in the days leading up to 9/11 in order to pursue one of the 9/11 hijackers has been documented in public media. Steve's married, lives in Northern Virginia, not exactly my neighbor, but he's pretty close, and he has a super awesome cool son, too. Steve, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Greg. It's been we've talked about it for a while, and so it's good to finally be able to come on. Thanks for having me.
I think we're going to have a lot of fun today, basically because I know this is not BAU like BAU on TV.
Exactly. You know, there's so many differences to the way it really operates in real life and the way it is on the television. I enjoy the television show because it's entertaining. I enjoy it to a point. My wife will say that she gets tired of watching television with me all the time because I'm busy yelling at the television screen saying that's not how it is in real life.
Yeah, I get that too. especially we watched Enemy of the State the other day.
Oh.
With the NSA police and the helicopters.
Oh, yeah, that's not real. That's not.
Apparently, I'm told no. Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah. So, great to be here.
Great. Well, I'm glad to have you. And just so everybody knows, Steve and I have been friends for about 2 millennia now, give or take a month or two.
Right.
Steve, why don't you tell everyone how we ended up running into each other and where we first met?
Yeah, so I started at the BAU in 2004. And after you go through the basic training at the time, becoming a profiler, one of the areas that they wanted to try to develop was not only looking at terrorism to try to develop profiling tools for terrorism, but also online behavior, hackers and cyber offenders. And so I was working on the program, putting together a lot of different ideas based on how we look at traditional crime scenes. And obviously, one of the best places to go for a lot of expertise on looking at networks and assessing networks and hackers, and probably having some of the hackers, people that, you know, if one or two things had changed in their life, might have ended up on the downside, right?
Right.
Ended up on the bad side, ended up at NSA and ran into you and your group and gave you guys a presentation on some of the things that we know as profilers, some of the ways we look at crime scenes, and trying to get some ideas from you guys as to what made sense and what didn't make sense and how we could work together. So I think immediately you and I hit it off.
Right.
And you liked a lot of the ideas, and a friendship was born from that point on.
You had a lot of good ideas, I have to admit. And in between shifts, when I was washing the dishes in the NSA kitchen, they let me come down and talk with folks like you to learn stuff.
Must have been some dishes. I don't believe that.
Oh, I tell you what, those dishes told some stories. They're all SIGINT dishes, yeah. But yeah, it's been golf ever since.
Yeah, and we're both avid golfers, so that if we weren't talking about this here today, we'd probably be out
on the golf course,
trying to find a reason to or a quiet place to talk about some of the stuff. But we've enjoyed a couple rounds over the years, and many more in the future.
Yeah, a few.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I remember one of the things I think that resonated with you was what we would call victimology.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, victimology, we were just talking before we started the show.
So, and just so folks understand, Steve worked at the BAU for a long time. You were there, what, 6 years?
6 years at BAU six and years. BSU for 2 years.
BSU. And explain the difference between BAU and BSU first.
Yeah, that's a great question. It used to be they were one and the same. And right after Waco, when the investigation ensued into Waco as to what we could have done better, one of the recommendations was that there should be a group of profilers outside of BSU that actually work in the same chain of command as the hostage rescue team, the hostage negotiators, and all those types of people that responded to the Waco situation.
Right.
And so they developed created another unit called the BAU, and took a certain portion of profilers out of BSU to go into BAU. So for a long period of time, there were two units. It was BSU and BAU, the Behavioral Analysis Unit and Behavioral Science Unit.
Right.
Nowadays, they've actually remerged, and there's no BSU. It's only BAU. but I actually worked at BAU for 6 years and then was fortunate enough to have the chance to go over to BSU to develop a course. BSU does probably a little bit more teaching than actual operational profiling, but they also teach the National Academy, which is an academy that's held at the FBI Academy for Law Enforcement from around the world. And I've taught and developed a graduate and undergraduate level course on behavior online, looking at behavior online and how to assess behavior online. So I did that for about 2 years before I went back to the field.
So when you recently retired, which is great, considering the fact that you didn't really retire that I could tell. I think you were home for what, 4 days, 5 days?
I think about 3 months. It'll be about 3 months, and I'm going back to work here in a week for a cybersecurity company in the area. Great firm that I'm very excited about. But my hat goes off to people that try to work.
And, of course, always looking for a job is a tough thing, especially when you have lots of things going on. But one of the things we talked about before was bureaucracy, and bureaucracy is always a problem in all types of jobs.
Yeah, definitely. You know, obviously the Federal Bureau of Investigation, bureaucracy is our middle name, and any government organization, you're going to have issues. And the private world is like that too. I'm not naive enough to think that, but you know, one of the things that I spent a little bit of time talking about, learning about, talking about and trying to apply is social network analysis. And one of the theories of social network analysis is, which I love, applied to what you and I try to do, right? Mm-hmm. Beat the hacker, beat the bad guy, is in order to defeat a flat network, you must become a flat network.
You have to be it, right?
Yeah. And so in trying to find my next job, the flattest network is working for yourself, I guess.
Sure.
Trying to find the right company that also is very flexible, can pivot very, very quickly, which I don't think all the time the FBI is very, very good at. And, you know, we joke about it, being the 800-pound gorilla. And certain elements, I think, of any government organization are going to be that big. But that's part of the job that I will not miss. And most people that worked with me would tell you that.
I'm very sure. As a matter of fact, they do pivot very well sometimes, like the Defense Department does, but they just spin.
Yeah, right. Or what's incredible is the amount of resources that the FBI can put on something.
Mm-hmm.
Not always very efficiently, but hundreds of agents can come into being. And that creates its own chaos sometimes. But that part of the job I will miss. right? The ability to be part of that 200-man person team or beyond that, like sure. what happened in the days after 9/11. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that is diametrically opposed to that ability to pivot and be flexible.
Right, and get something done.
All those layers of managers and everything above it. So
sure. In case you're just joining us, this is Greg Carpenter, Reverse Deception Radio on the Veritas Radio Network Crusade Channel. And today in studio, we have retired Special Agent, Supervisory Special Agent, super awesome cool Supervisory Special Agent, Steve Bongart from the FBI, who has worked some very interesting cases over the years. And, of course, we're talking about bureaucracy because that's probably one of the most important things that as federal employees, I mean, you don't even have to get classes to learn how to be good at bureaucracy just simply because you do it every day. And you really try to cut that stuff down, try to cut it out of your diet as much as possible, but some things you just can't overcome. So some of the things that Steve's done in his background, he's been in the BAU for the FBI. He's a cyber forensic guru. He's a sniper, so he'll shoot your computer if you don't watch it. But also he worked in Afghanistan in December 2001, right after 9/11. But the other thing that Steve did, and I want to talk about it a little bit here, is he was one of the primary investigators for the TWA Flight 800. Now, if you remember, we had a discussion, a two-episode discussion on TWA Flight 800. We brought forth some data, and we had a very in-depth look at what the data meant and how it plotted out. And Steve was actually the investigator on this very terrible, tragic incident. I thought that since I had him here in studio, we would talk about that a little bit, sure. if we could do that.
Yeah, no, I think it's a... I think to this day, there's a lot of questions in people's mind. There's a lot of question in my mind mm-hmm. as to what exactly happened. But I think, and I think it's still a pending and active case, I think technically, at the FBI, which means that if certain information comes forward, we would have the ability to open it up again and bring those 100, 200, 300 agents to bear if that's what it took. But I think there's still a certain amount of questions, and I specifically pursued the missile theory. I was a brand new agent out of Quantico, happened to be in the command post on, the, like you said, that tragic night, being in the right place at the wrong time because right. it was a horrific event that happened. And I remember my first rocket science type comment that Mr. Kallstrom turned to me and said, "How do you know that?" was when there was a question as to, there was a 15-minute difference between the time we were getting from Kennedy for when the plane took off and the time that other people were saying the plane took off. So me being the incredibly smart person that I am, I said, "Well, sir, I think that's probably the push-away time versus the time it actually left the runway." And he said, "How do you know that?" And I said, "I was a pilot in the Navy." And he goes, "Really? Get your... out to Long Island," because at that point in time we already had some information or some witnesses that were claiming to see what they believed was a flare or something going up to the plane. So very early on, I was along with another agent working on the missile theory for TW-800. So it was a year and a half of extremely difficult trying to prove a negative, which is very, very hard to do.
Almost impossible in most cases, yeah.
It's almost impossible. And there's still some question as to, what I can say is, I think at the time people said there were 200 people that saw a missile.
Right.
You and I were talking about this before. And that is not correct. We had probably, the vast majority of witnesses were seeing some part of the plane fall apart. Mm. There are probably half a dozen to a dozen eyewitnesses to this day that I can't explain what they saw. They saw something that didn't make sense, that what they were seeing was the plane.
Okay. And so I want everyone to understand that one of the reasons I asked Steve to be on today was so that we could actually have exactly accurate information as far as what happened. Now, I had those two shows and I collected everything I could collect and find out everything I could find out, but that happened over a 6-month period in my spare time as I had the opportunity to look for things and put everything together. Obviously, I could not be 100% accurate. I tried. So some of the things that Steve is going to tell you will conflict with things that I spoke of before, and that's because he has firsthand intimate knowledge of everything that happened. I did not. I took secondary data sources. I did get the data set to look at the radar data. I was actually able to plot it and do all those things. So understand that whatever I said before was just my attempt to try to do what Steve can succinctly tell you today in a much better way than I ever could.
So I would say either that or Steve can't remember. I can't remember, which very well could be part of it. But it was, you know, it was such a complex investigation. We tried to go back over the radar data.
Right.
And we had the advantage of an individual who was amazing with looking at the secondary radar returns and piecing them together. So we had that ability to do that over a long period of time. So I give a nod to anyone who's going back over that investigation and the number of files and from Freedom of Information Act requests and trying to piece it together. The eyewitnesses that we had that are still to this day in my heart problematic,
mm-hmm.
I was a brand new agent at the time.
Right.
Since then, you know, 18 years later, I know eyewitnesses sometimes can be horrific with how they remember things and what they remember
sure.
things to be. You know, one of the things you and I talked about was the video that was done. When the video was done, I have utmost respect for the analysts from our sister agency,
mm-hmm.
Langley, that did that. They're two of the smartest, the main analysts for that are two of the smartest people I've ever met. However, in my opinion, they took one of the major witness statements and then created the video and then tried to bootstrap a lot of what was seen to try to explain it, try to help people out. I mean, their reason was not to cover something up. Their reason was try to help explain something and get us out of an investigation that we had not found one piece of evidence that the plane was shot down by a missile, or certainly that we had done it. So I understand kind of why things happen that way, you know, from an organizational psychology perspective. But
right.
when we were making that video, I was adamant against it at the time and had written one or two documents about it, because I realized in the way it was going to play going forward was people were going to say, oh, this is a conspiracy. You tried to come up with this video that is proving what everybody saw, and it's not proving what the most problematic witnesses saw. And I think those were some of the people immediately after the video came out that were espousing a lot of different things.
Sure.
Especially people very smart, like I think Commander Donaldson at the time.
Yep.
Some of the people that were following up on that. So. Yep.
And anytime you take one of the outliers from a, I would call it a linear regression, per se,
certainly.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
And you take and you explain the outlier, well, that doesn't actually explain the regression. It doesn't actually explain the relationship between what happened. It just shows you've changed where the linear graph is going to be displayed. It's going to give you a completely wrong answer.
Right. Absolutely. And especially that happens a lot, right? One of the things we try to do psychologically is we try to simplify things. And when we try to simplify things, sometimes it makes it easier to communicate, but it doesn't really explain the real world.
Right. You're absolutely right. So we're into a hard break right now. This is Gregory Carpenter, Reverse Deception Radio.
She's filled with secrets.
With retired FBI Special Agent Steve Bongart in studio. And we'll be back at the end of these messages.
You know that I'm loving you. In a god of a Vita, baby, don't you know that I'll always be true. Oh, won't you come with me, and I'll take my hand. Oh, won't you come with me, and I'll walk this land. In a god of
We're giving you 5 minutes to gather the Pentagon-sized pile of scales that's fallen from your eyes. Reverse Deception. We'll be right back on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.